And welcome to another edition of the Odyssey Radio Show. I'm your host, Mike Schultz. We talk about ancient mysteries and modern mysteries. And since it's a hot summer day, we're just going to have some good old-fashioned fun tonight. We're going to talk about horror movies and scary movies and going all the way back to the beginning of film. And I brought on John Stanley tonight. He wrote a great book. It's called I Was a TV Horror Host. So he is an expert on this subject. And welcome to the show, John Stanley.
Well, thank you for calling it a great book.
I loved it. It was
fun. And thank you for having the courage to invite a former horror host, now retired, onto your radio show.
Absolutely. Well, you're the right guy, because I love scary movies. And, you know, why is it that, you know, kind of gentle people, nonviolent, every once in a while we have to, you know, kind of watch a good scary movie? Why do you think that is?
Absolutely. You got to shake yourself up a little bit. You got to get the blood rolling through your veins. Let me explain what that's all about.
Okay.
If you could, for just a
Please
moment.
Please do, yeah.
It was really Ray Bradbury who taught me this. I think you know who he is.
Sure.
Okay. He's one of our finest fantasy science fiction writers. When I was very young, about 10, 11 years old, I discovered some of his books, Martian Chronicles, Illustrated Man. Also, I was reading the EC comics from Bill Gaines out of New York, and he was actually adapting some of the Ray Bradbury short stories into comic book form. So I was very aware of him, and my whole life seemed to go onto a new level. It's like I was discovering something. I wasn't sure what it was. And I just became so fascinated with science fiction, movies, pulp magazines, novels. I would go to the high school library to find things. It wasn't until 1968, the first time I met Ray at his office in Hollywood, or actually Beverly Hills, excuse me, he told me what it was. I said, Ray, you woke me up. My whole life changed when I read your books. And he said, John, we're all born with a sleeping child within us, and as we discover the joys of life, as we discover sex, as we discover music, good food, whatever it is that turns us on, that part of that child is awakened, and finally it forms within us the sense of wonder. And you are describing to me your sense of wonder. I turn part of that on for you. And please, never allow your sense of wonder to turn itself off. Always have that motivating you, pushing you, driving you. It's the thing that will keep you alive for the longest time.
That explains it better than I've ever heard it.
Okay.
So let's get into the history of horror films. I know that during the 30s, Dracula and Frankenstein came out. Was that the first big wave to take us back?
Yes. We must start with a man named Carl Limley, Jr. Carl Limley, Sr. was one of those entrepreneurs of the Nickelodeon business back on the East Coast when the movie business first started at the turn of the 20th century. Of course, Thomas Alva Edison held a patent on the motion picture camera, so in order to escape having to make the gigantic payments that he insisted upon, many of the entrepreneurs left the East Coast, went west. Meanwhile, their lawyers fought what became known as the patent wars, and when these entrepreneurs got to the West Coast, the tracks ran out in Santa Monica. They began to say, this is the place where we can start our new studios away, as far away from Thomas Alva Edison as we can get. And thus was the beginning of Hollywood as we know it today.
Uh-huh.
Okay, that's where it begins. Now, Carl Limley Sr. starts Universal Studios, which today is probably one of the best-known studios because of all the entertainment values it brings to us through its tours. Well, let me tell you, Carl Limley Sr. retired around 1929, 1930, and he turned over the studio to Carl Limley Jr., his son, who was all of 21 years old.
Wow.
Now, Carl Limley Jr. had a vision of movies being epics. So we had All Quiet on the Western Front, one of the great war movies of all time. King of Jazz, starring Paul Whiteman and his orchestra, the first film to star Bing Crosby. That was the first giant musical. Well, Carl had visions of other things, too, such as monster movies, horror movies, special effects. This was very important to him. And thus we had Dracula, we had The Mummy, we had Frankenstein, The Invisible Man. All of these films that came out of those early years of Universal are the result of this very young, seemingly inexperienced executive in his early 20s who nevertheless never let go of this vision. Michael, I'm sorry to tell you that the vision is what destroyed him. He spent so much money making his films, fulfilling his own personal dream. The studio couldn't keep up to it. And by the time that he was around 25, 26 years old, the board of directors, or whatever you call them at Universal, took control away from him. And that was about all he did for the rest of his life. So if we want to look at the rudimentary beginnings of horror and science, basically horror films in Hollywood, it's really Carl Imlay Jr. who sets things into motion, who's so driven to have special effects. Look at the early films, special effects like we have never seen before.
Absolutely. Now, take us up to around 1950. Television is really taking off, and these movie studios come up with an idea to sell packages of horror films, but they don't want to give their good stuff to TV, right? So
well,
it's all,
yes,
all of the junk.
Television really begins around 1947, 48, you know, the coming of Uncle Milty, one of the first television star. Every Tuesday night, originally he was only going to be on for a few weeks as a summer replacement, but he hit the right nerve within the people at the time, and he got a 30-year contract when it was all over with. Well, there is this battle between Hollywood, as it has become known, the studio system, and this newfangled thing called television with the 11-inch screen in your home. Only about 1% of the homes in 1947 had these televisions. Nevertheless, the neighbors would come to your house to watch Uncle Milty on Tuesday night. That's the profound effect that it had. Well, throughout the early 50s, there was this constant battle between television and movies. The movies wanted the people to come to the theaters, forget the television, they wouldn't allow their stars to associate with it. It was taboo, stay away from it, until Walt Disney. Walt Disney is the turning point, Michael.
Really?
He wants money to start a little place there somewhere in, what's it called?
Anaheim.
Disneyland, I think. Anaheim, thank you. I remember that for a moment. And he needed money to start his dream of Disneyland, so ABC Television agreed to let him do a show on its network. And because he agreed to do that, that was the first time a television studio associated with a movie studio, and it was so successful in ratings and everything else that Fox Studios, under Daryl Zanuck, said, hey, we're going to do this too. And more importantly, Michael, Warner Brothers, Jack L. Warner, said, we're going to do a TV series called Warner Brothers Presents. We're going to have a rotating series of shows. We're going to do Casablanca, we're going to do King's Row, and we're going to do Cheyenne, a new Western based on an old film. Well, Cheyenne turned out to be the great winner of that, and this turned around the whole attitude between television and movies. And so it is in 1957, once the ice is broken by the people I've mentioned, now the movie studios say, we're going to release some of our really good films to television.
Finally.
Finally, Michael. Yeah. And that includes all those great Universal films. It's called Shock. And this is where the horror host begins.
Right. All of a sudden, you need all of these hosts to do these movie evenings and afternoons. Now, tell us about Vampira, the first kind of
Vampira.
Famous
yes,
host
yes, yes.
in the 50s.
I'm glad you asked.
Sure.
Vampira. She was the very first horror host in America on television, not in the movies, not on radio. Those were other venues, other media.
Mm-hmm.
No, it was, just a moment here. This is a woman who was working for, let me start at the beginning. Her name is Mala Nurmi, Nurmi. She went to a costume party in L.A., dressed in an outfit that looked like Morticia from the Addams Family.
Sure.
I mean, at least that would be a comparison.
Exactly.
And Hunt Stromberg, Jr., who worked at KABC, the Los Angeles, L.A. affiliate station, had a package of films. And when he saw her at this party, he thought, I wonder if that wouldn't be a good way for us to kick off this series of films. She could introduce the films dressed in this Vampira kind of a costume, and play this kind of unusual character. This was indeed the very first TV horror host in the U.S. culture, absolutely. And it didn't last very long. It lasted about 2 years. There were some problems. There's all kinds of stories. There's one story that she was going to be blacklisted because of some kind of communistic affiliation. I don't know if that's true or not. Some say it was over money. Some say it was over the costume. Anyway, after a couple of years, she was gone, and it was then that Ed Wood Jr., who had seen her on TV, knowing she was unemployed, hired her for Plan 9 from Outer Space.
Worst film ever made, correct?
The best worst film ever made.
I've never seen it, so you're going to have to explain what's so ridiculous about this film. I mean,
Film is so incompetent, truly incompetent in every way, in acting style, in special effects, in story development, that it's so bad it becomes good.
Exactly.
You know how we have our secret pleasures or hidden pleasures?
That's it.
Have you ever watched Walker, Texas Ranger?
Yes,
Michael?
Sure.
Do you ever tell anybody you watch it?
No, it's a secret.
It's a secret. Absolutely.
I also read Mad Magazine. I don't tell anybody that either.
Oh, yeah. Well, Mad Magazine I started reading in 1952. I don't think you were around then.
But
Bill Gaines, I'm sorry?
Oh, I'm sorry. She did not want to speak in this movie, correct? She wanted to hide in the background? And
yeah, she wanted to minimize. The reason for that is she wanted to minimize herself because she thought this was horrible.
Right.
Oh, God. And she thought nobody would ever see this movie. She thought it's so bad, I won't say a word. In fact, apparently her panties had holes in them at the time.
Low budget.
She went down there with such a low budget film, and she had to bring her own stuff. And later she would say, "Yep, I had holes in my panties." But anyway, she thought nobody's ever going to go see this. Well, the movie bombed in the theaters.
Initially,
it's television. It's always television where these wonderful things are discovered. These wonderful horrible things are discovered.
It's like a safety net, right? But what I don't understand is that Ed Wood got funding from the Baptist Church for this movie. How did they get mixed up into this?
Oh, yes, and they came to him. You know what? I guess if we went back and looked at the original, the Ed Wood movie, maybe there's something in there that tells us that. But they were very upset because the original title of the film was Grave Robbers from Outer Space, not Plan 9 from Outer Space, Grave Robbers. And they felt, the Baptist Church members felt that, or the financiers felt, Grave Robbers was sacrilegious. That was a word you could not use. So that's why the film was retitled.
I see. And apparently Bela Lugosi was so down on his luck, he had to accept a role in this, too.
He was watching television one night with Ed Wood Jr., and apparently they saw Vampira do one of her final shows. And he was very impressed, I hope I can say this on the air, with her jugs.
We can say jugs. Sure.
Okay, good. All right. Go for the jugular, right?
Exactly. Now, take us up to the 60s. It seems like The Night of the Living Dead was the film that kind of kicked off a revival. Is that true?
George Romero, yes, this was a film that really tapped in to something that no one could have ever predicted. This was like so many low-budget movies of the time. There were producers, directors out there making these films, but occasionally one of them would strike the right nerve, and George Romero certainly found it. He made this film on weekends. It was a very difficult, long-term project, and yet, when it came out, it just absolutely tapped into the horror consciousness of America. It worked. Whatever it is that makes these things work, and I guess we need a psychiatrist to come on the show, Dr. Frederick Wortham, perhaps, to describe to us exactly what that's all about. But it worked. It's a film that even today continues to work.
I see. Now, as far as early 70s, a bit later, I have this theory that the Texas Chainsaw Massacre changed everything, and it brought a lot of blood and gore into horror films, which we see today. What do you think of that?
That was certainly one of the films that did that. The film, you know what, if I could be honest with you, I think the film that was the turning point in many ways was Alien. Alien was a science fiction movie on the surface, and yet underneath it was a horror film, wasn't it? It was both genres that were very cleverly blended together, and this opened up horizons that are still being explored today. And what was that film? That was in 1979. That's over 25 years. That film, for me, if you were to ask me, John, what's the corner post film from the 70s, I would have to say Alien.
Interesting. Now, I would point to, there was something about Halloween that really clicked with the public. It was very low budget, no names, no stars.
Well, it was very cleverly directed.
Right.
By John Carpenter. The film also had a very unusual musical score that's still identified with that.
Very
creepy. I cannot hear that music without, or some variation of it, without totally identifying with John Carpenter.
Were they the first ones to use the camera as the killer, like you're walking through the hallway?
No. You're talking about a point of view shot.
Point of view.
If you think very carefully back to Psycho, there are all kinds of points of view in Psycho. Remember when I think the sister is walking toward the house, and we have her point of view of the house as she's approaching it. We also have the point of view of the man who's later killed in the house. Alfred Hitchcock, if you look at any of his films, he always used the point of view shot. This is also true of Vertigo and any other, The Birds. There's always he always wanted the camera to take the point of view of one of the characters, because he felt that you become that character. You are in the shoes or the high heels of that particular character, and that character is now going to carry you deeper and deeper into the horror of the story.
What was his overall impact? I know in the 50s were a lot of his big films. Did he just raise the stakes and make it much more classier and cerebral as far as horror films go?
You're talking about Hitchcock now?
Yeah.
Alfred Hitchcock really reached a turning point with Psycho. Psycho is an anomaly within the... If you look at his history as a filmmaker, he did do films that were mainly suspense films. If you look at North by Northwest, mm-hmm. and the films from the mid-50s, it's not until Psycho do we really get into the horror genre. And as you know, Psycho was not an easy film for him to make. He knew that he was pushing the edges of the envelope at the time he made it.
And he killed off the star in the first...
He killed off the star in the first,
half hour,
40 minutes of the
right.
film, which... was it totally unheard of in the history of Hollywood. That just wasn't done then.
But brilliant, because...
It was a brilliant idea.
Who would expect that?
Because it threw the viewer completely askew off. The viewer, from that point on in that film, is not comfortable.
No.
You know,
no.
We go to our movies, and we viscerally enjoy them. We usually know where we are. We're with a hero. We're with the heroine. Who's, you know, being attacked, but we're with her. She's going to survive this somehow. But in the case of Psycho, I still remember this film, Michael. I saw it at the RKO Theater in San Francisco at 11 o'clock in the morning, and I sat up in the balcony.
Sure.
And I want to tell you, there was nobody else up there.
Uh-oh.
I was the only person. To this day, 47 years later, I still remember being the only person in that balcony.
That's not a good feeling. But I also know about Hitchcock. He had a pretty poor relationship with his actresses, like Kim Novak. And it was difficult.
Tippi Hedren?
Sure, apparently.
Very hard
filming.
I talked to Tippi a couple of years ago. I still write for the San Francisco Chronicle occasionally.
Mm-hmm.
I was there for 33 years as an entertainment writer, as well as my horror hosting, the book I wrote. But Tippi told me that Hitchcock wanted to take the female of the story, the woman in peril, and put her into a situation where she felt that she was endangered. Not to pretend she's endangered, but he wanted her to feel that she was endangered. There's a wonderful story that Patricia Hitchcock, his daughter, once told me. Could I share it with you?
Absolutely.
They were making a movie called Strangers on a Train. Okay? And there's a sequence set at a carnival. And so Hitchcock actually was filmed it at a carnival. And he put his daughter, Patricia, into the Ferris wheel. And he knew that she was afraid of heights.
Mm.
So the Ferris wheel started up on the arc to the top. And he had it all coordinated. He told the control man, stopped the Ferris wheel at the very top, which the Ferris man did, and then he said, turn out the lights throughout the entire carnival. And they had control of that, and the lights went out, and Patricia told me personally, she got to the top of the arc thinking she was just going to go for a Ferris wheel ride, but it suddenly stopped, it jarred to a stop, and then the lights went out everywhere, and she was utterly petrified. She was so unable to reason about why is this happening. Is my dad playing a trick on me? There's no way she could have done that. She was absolutely petrified. Now, Alfred Hitchcock attained achieved what he wanted, but at the expense of his daughter's emotions. So, relate that now to the birds, where Tippi Hedren is locked up in a room with the birds for several hours. And she can't. Hitchcock keeps filming and filming, and he won't let her go. These are the kind of stories you hear from his actresses.
Yes.
And if you hear it from his daughter, then you sort of suspect all of these stories are true.
It must be true,
yeah.
Certainly.
Yeah.
I want to ask you. I know you hosted a horror TV show from 78 to 84.
Yes.
Tell me a little bit about what that was like. That kind of dream job. I mean, did you watch all the films first, and what was your day like?
No, I didn't have really time to do that. Sometimes I would. I would bring the films home if I hadn't seen them. There were many films I had seen because I was, since the age of 11, when I discovered Howard Hawks' The Thing.
Mm-hmm.
That same summer, I discovered The Day the Earth Stood Still. And from then on, I was really a science fiction and horror fan. Well, this was a very difficult time for me because in addition to hosting a show that required a half hour of material every week, I had to write for the San Francisco Chronicle. I was still a full-time writer, so I would have to figure out in advance who my guests were going to be, what kind of segments I would present. I would have to write a script. I would have to write the questions, answers. I would have to lay out what kind of pictures I wanted, what kind of film clips. I also made what are called mini-movies. This was an attempt to do a parody or an imitation of a film form that I could do on something that was currently happening or locally happening. Do you remember Phantasm with Don Coscarelli?
Vaguely. A real creepy film,
It was
right?
a 1979 film. And
is
I think
that the one where they throw the ball?
Yeah,
the ball
has the knife in it.
Yes.
There were three sequels of this film. It was very, very popular. It really tapped into the visceral reactions of movie audiences. Well, what I did for my interview, I asked Don Coscarelli and Angus Scrimm, the tall man.
The creepy old man, yeah.
Yeah, if they could meet me at a cemetery here on the outskirts of San Francisco in Colma, which is famous for all its burial grounds, if they could meet me there, and they did, I had a hearse. And we worked out a little business where Angus Scrimm picks me up and throws me into the back of a hearse, locks the door, and we go driving through the cemetery, and Don Coscarelli says, you are a captive audience. You're going to listen to everything I say, and you're going to go back and tell your viewers on Creature Features about my new film. That was the basic premise, and then Don would tell me how he made the film and the underlying themes and so on. And Angus Scrimm would say, oh, we're very proud of our film and all the dead corpses and bodies that are in it. You
right.
know, it made it very macabre and wonderful because after that interview ran, I got all kinds of mail and everybody said, John, make more of these films. So I tried as often as I could to make what I called a mini movie. We did a Casablanca, Return to Casablanca, Nightmare in the Chamber of Horrors, The Attack of the Incredible Killer Scarecrow. There were all kinds of things. I would take things from real life, things that were happening, and devise a story around that.
Right. Now, you had a lot of celebrities come visit your show on the way up the ladder. Tell me about Arnold Schwarzenegger as a young man. What was he like?
Well, yes. Let me first tell your listeners, if they go to stanleybooks.net, they will find there a list of all the celebrities that I interviewed over my 33 years in the business, on television or for the newspaper. There are literally hundreds of them. Arnold Schwarzenegger came into my life in 1977 when Carl Malden gave me a call. Carl was making Streets of San Francisco. We'd been friends for a few years, and occasionally Carl or an agent would call me up. Hey, John, we got somebody in town that we think might make a good story.
Uh-huh.
We've got this bodybuilder guy. He's got a great sense of humor. Why don't you come over and talk to him? He's only going to be here for a few days, and then he's gone. So there was an opening to interview him one evening at the Fisherman's Wharf restaurant. So I went in. I met him for the very first time. Pumping Iron was, I think, a year old at that time. Very few people knew who he was. He was playing a psychotic killer on an episode of The Streets of San Francisco.
Really?
You spend a few minutes warming up to somebody. We're in the cocktail lounge, and this beautiful cocktail waitress with a short skirt and a low-cut bodice comes up to Mr. Schwarzenegger, looks around the room furtively, and says, "Oh, I'm so sorry, Arnold. I won't be able to come up to your hotel room tonight." And Arnold looked like a man who had been totally offended.
So,
he looked at her like he was in a state of shock.
Right.
And she said, "There's just this rule the hotel has. We can't come up to your room. We can't fraternize with the customers, as it were." Well, Arnold was, he acted like he was devastated. I could see it was an act. So he said to this beautiful young woman, "I tell you what we do. I know what to do." He says, "You go outside. I will go up to my room. I will open the window. I throw a rope down. You grab the rope. I pull you in. I close the window. Nobody knows. You and I could then be together."
So that gives you a window into his character. But he was also very assertive, and he knew he was going to make it, didn't he?
Yes, absolutely. As this poor girl left the room, totally baffled about how to react to this bit of, satire, I guess you could call it, on sexual behavior. We went on with the interview. We had dinner, and I did all the usual cliche questions and things that a reporter wants to ask. And at one point he said, "Very soon," he says, "in 2 years, I will be a major motion picture star. You will see me as a hero up on the screen. I will replace all of the existing movie heroes." Well, that was 1977, and it was in 1982, and what's that, 5 years later?
Uh-huh.
He said 2 years. It's now 5 years later, Michael. I'm taking a plane to Burbank to see a film that night, and I'm sitting there. Remember, I'm suddenly having a flashback to Arnold telling me this, and I'm going, wait a minute, I'm on my way to see Conan the Barbarian, Arnold Schwarzenegger's first film, and that night, I saw him up on that big, giant 50-foot screen just as he had vowed I would see him. Well, it took him a few more years than he had said.
But I thought
to myself, if this man tells you something, you better listen.
Yeah, exactly. He wants to be governor, and he did that, too.
Well,
but,
he did that, too, right.
Yeah, let me ask you, there's this photo in the book of Christopher Jones, and this blew my mind because very few people know who he is. Very few people have gone to Hollywood, become stars, and completely disappeared. So why don't you explain who Christopher Jones is and whatever happened to him?
Well, you know, I'm not sure that I can tell you all that you want to know about Christopher Jones, but I will say this. He was doing a show. He was working in one of the studios. I wish I could remember the studio.
He looks just like James Dean, too.
Yes, he was from that school of acting.
Right.
This was a Jesse James television series. Do you remember the full title of it? I'm trying to remember
now. In the book, I think it was, The Adventures of Jesse James.
The Adventures of Jesse James, was that it?
I know he made a few movies in Hollywood and got real famous and then disappeared completely.
Let me tell you the story. The unusual thing that I remember, I only met him the one time. He was on the soundstage making the film, and the PR person from the network was with me. You always went on the set with someone from the network who was the unit representative for that show. And he said, "We're going to get Chris here for you. He's our new up-and-coming star." And he came back a little later. He says, "I can't find Chris. I don't know where he is." And we actually... You won't believe this, Michael, but we walked around this whole soundstage looking for Christopher Jones, and we couldn't find him. This went on for a good half hour. Finally, he said, the PR man said, sit in the chair over here. I did, and just waited. And pretty soon he came back with Chris Jones. Chris Jones was so afraid to be interviewed, and I was the first person to ever interview him. He didn't want to do it. He was hiding back in the dressing room somewhere. The guy found him and said, look, this guy's come all the way from San Francisco. You got to talk to him.
Right.
So Chris finally reluctantly sat down, and we had an interview. Now, that was a long time ago. That was 1965, I think. All I can remember is, yes, he was a little reticent. He was a little shy. And yet, I got enough material to go back and, you know, write a story. Now, the nice thing of the thing you look for when you're a journalist is for the unusual story. So I learned something early in my career. Always write the story the way it happened. Don't impose your attitude on it. Don't be upset that he wouldn't come and talk to you. Just write it objectively and let the reader make his own determination about what's going on here. And that was a learning lesson for me. Write the story objectively, because this kind of thing would happen again. Remember Irwin Allen?
The disaster movies, right?
Yes. Well, before that, how about Lost in Space?
Well, that was kind of a weird show.
How about Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea?
Right, that was
He was a champion producer at 20th Century Fox for these series in the early 60s that specialized in science fiction, fantasy, and horror with special effects. Now, you would think that Irwin Allen would be a wonderful person to talk to.
Sure.
No way. I went into his office at Fox. I sat down. I had a list of questions. You can imagine I was a very serious newspaper man. I took myself seriously. I wanted to have good stories. Wanted to find out what people were thinking, what they were doing. And I started talking about science fiction with Irwin Allen. He was not happy with that. I was asking what must have been to him tough questions. They weren't insulting questions. They were just the kind of things that you would want to know from a producer of successful TV shows. And after about 15 minutes, he said, we got into a little difference of opinion about Ray Bradbury. He said Ray Bradbury had never written a script for Hollywood. I said, I beg your pardon. How about It Came from Outer Space? There's now a book out that has all of his story outlines and scripts and so on for that very project. He didn't want to believe me and asked me to leave the office.
Well, you never know with people.
Sometimes you just meet some strange people.
Yeah, absolutely.
I hope you don't feel that way about me.
No, not at all. Let's talk about the Amityville Horror. A lot of people don't know about this house. It's based on a true story, but talk about the murders that occurred in the house before the lefts moved into it.
Well, the only thing that I can really share with you about the Amityville house are the demonologists, better known as Ed and Lorraine Warren.
Mm-hmm.
Are you familiar
yeah.
with them?
Yeah.
Okay, Ed is dead now. He died, I think, 2 years ago. Ed and Lorraine came to San Francisco to promote the sequel to the Amityville Horror called The Possession in 1982. And we met in a wine cellar at Orsi's Restaurant, a very famous restaurant in San Francisco. And because we were doing an interview, I guess management thought, let's put them down in the wine cellar where we'll have some privacy, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So we went down to the wine cellar, and I was with my wife, Erica. She's a beautiful, although short, 4'10", a blonde from Germany, sort of a blitzkrieg in herself.
Mm-hmm.
And occasionally has had some unusual psychic experiences. But nothing like what happened that night, Mike. Here's what happened. We all sat down in the wine cellar, and we're talking to Ed and Lorraine Warren, the demonologists who had investigated the Amityville house. They had been in it and been through some strange experiences. But right now they were out on the road promoting a movie. So how seriously can you take all that, right? Are you with me here?
Sure.
Okay. So all of a sudden, Erica, my beautiful wife, blonde, she grabs my arm and she says, there's something standing in the doorway. Well, I looked over in the doorway of the wine cellar. I didn't see anything. And the Ed and Lorraine Warren are talking away. We're just getting acquainted. They act like nothing's wrong. They're not sensing anything. But she kept clutching my arm, and it was so desperate. It was so tight. Her fingernails were digging into my flesh that I finally said, honey, I'm going to go look. I walked out in the corridor. I couldn't see anything. The maitre d' from upstairs came down. He says, is everything okay here? What's going on? We just couldn't find anything out of the ordinary. And finally, she relaxed her grip on my arm, and she says, whatever was there is gone. And to this day, I cannot explain, Mike, what happened. But then something else happened a little later. Across the table from me, a PR man for the film was setting, and all of a sudden we saw a drop fall from above, a great big drop, and it went splat on the surface of the table. I looked up overhead. Granted, there were some pipes overhead. We're in a wine cellar, okay, down in the basement, but I couldn't see any moisture, and I didn't think too much more about it. And all of a sudden, another drop fell. Well, this man across the table from me jumped up. He backed away from his chair. He said, I'm not going to sit here any longer. I've had enough of this. And he went way down to the other end of the table where Ed and Lorraine were and sat on the far side of them. And Ed and Lorraine, very strangely, acted so normal, like they didn't have a clue about what was happening. They didn't have any sensations about it. They just continued to sit there. So I finally, when another drop came down, I got up on a chair, and I reached up in there. I looked for a wet spot where the water might come from.
Mm-hmm.
I could not find anything that was out of the ordinary there. Everything was bone dry. And finally, I had to come down off the chair and tell everybody at the table, I cannot find anything unusual. There is no moisture at all. I don't know where these drops are coming from.
Wow. Yeah, that house had a murder where a young man killed his whole family before. So
oh, boy, yes. I have a complete account of that in my book. I was a TV horror host. The mother, the father, the son, the daughter, they were all shot by the son, one of the
right.
other. A 23-year-old son, Ronald, shot to death all the members of his family, his father, his mother, his sisters, Dawn and Allison. He had two brothers, Mark and Johnson. So there were six people he killed.
Well, that would account for poltergeist activity, I believe.
Now, the Warrens told me some very strange stories about that house. And, in fact, Lorraine actually came back a couple of years ago. They had a new Amityville horror film. Remember that?
Mm-hmm, sure.
And she came back, and I got the Chronicle to allow me to interview her again. And she told me there was no way on God's earth that she would ever, ever go back to that house. And she told me about the time that she and Ed were on a drive through Connecticut on Interstate 84, and they saw a sign that read Promised Land. Now, this is really ironic. And Lord's Valley.
Uh-huh.
They saw a sign that read, first they saw a sign, Promised Land, and Ed made a joke about that. Then they saw a sign, Lord's Valley, and suddenly, according to Lorraine, the car went out of control, inexplicably, because Ed was always an excellent driver, but he couldn't keep control of the steering wheel, crashed through a guardrail, went down a 40-foot embankment, and she saw some rocks below, and she started praying, thinking, in the split second she had left, oh my God, the car's going to hit those rocks and we'll explode and be killed. But the car stopped short of the rocks.
Huh.
And both of them came out of it alive. And according to Lorraine, Ed turned to her, and he was white. He was ghastly white, utterly shaken. And he said, oh, Lorraine, even the Amityville Horror couldn't get us tonight.
That was a warning. Let me ask you, on this show, we talk about ancient mysteries a lot, and Eric von Däniken wrote all these famous books, like Chariots
of
the Gods.
Yeah, did
you interview him?
Yes. It's been a long time. It was back in 1974,
mm-hmm.
and I still remember the image of him in front of me. I wish I could shed some new light on, you know, some of these mysteries, these ancient mysteries. They have certainly fascinated me. And I, you know, used to be a listener on radio of all these programs that dealt with this, you know, coast to coast.
Uh-huh.
And so, in effect, George Norrie interviewed me just a few weeks ago about some of these weird things.
Right. How did he impress you, or did he lay out the whole theory pretty clearly, or?
Well, gosh, it's been, you know, it's been so many years,
uh-huh.
And actually, my interview with him was intended to go into this new book. I was a TV horror host, but I finally, I guess we ran out of space or energy or something. But he'll be in my next book, I guarantee it.
Absolutely. So let's talk a bit about, there's a Bavarian mansion in Oakland, very famous.
Oh, yes.
With kind of a weird history. And
it's called the Slaughterhouse, Michael.
Right. You met the most famous psychic in America, probably, Sylvia Brown at a seance. Why don't you talk about that?
Oh, boy. Was that unforgettable? I got to tell you, that was a night to remember. There's absolutely no doubt about it. It was called the Slaughterhouse. It's the oldest existing house in Oakland, California.
Mm-hmm.
And it's called the Slaughterhouse because the man who owned it was John Slaughter. He was an advertising guy out of San Francisco, so that was kind of tongue-in-cheek. And in 1978, just before I began my job as a TV horror host, I got a call from In Search Of. Remember the series that Leonard Nimoy used to narrate? Howard Lipstone asked me on the phone one day, the show's producer, would you like to come to a seance at the most haunted house in the San Francisco Bay Area? It scared the pants off a lot of people, and maybe it'll scare the pants off of you. So I said, okay. So one night, on a Saturday night, in November 1978, I went over to the house, and I met a psychic. Maybe you have heard of him, a parapsychologist, Frank Nocerino.
No, I haven't.
Oh, he lived in Pinole, California, which is very
uh-huh.
close to Oakland.
Uh-huh.
And he's a very famous psychic. He had done a lot of research on this house. He had put a camera up and taken hundreds of photographs. He showed me his scrapbooks. He would put a camera, he'd point the camera at a certain wall, and he would begin to take pictures on a timer. He'd come back later, and he'd have a roll of film, you know, with pictures spaced out. And many of the photographs he took in this strange house had little funny blotches on them. They looked like something's wrong. What is that? You know, is something wrong with the negative or the camera? They could never find any explanation for these strange blotches. One photograph, Mike, that I'll never forget was of a wall that had newspapers pasted up on it. You couldn't quite make out what the newspapers said. And I asked... I asked Frank, what's that all about? And he said, I don't know, I can't explain it, but I have a hunch that sometime in the past, somebody had put newspapers to cover up the wall for whatever reason, and we're looking back through time, the spectrum of time.
Hmm.
Well, I don't know.
Well, when Sylvia Brown did the seance.
Sylvia Brown was at a seance, yes.
What did she find out?
She and a lady named Antoinette May, who's currently a best-selling writer with Pilot's Wife, she used to cover these things. She used to be an investigative reporter. And so she was at the table with me. And Sylvia and her husband, who's Dahl, D-A-L, they were at the table. We all joined hands, just like you see in a film.
Uh-huh.
And Sylvia went into this deep trance, and she began to describe all kinds of strange images that came to her that night. There were two men, one dark and curly-haired. The name Adrian popped into her mind. The name Katie, there's a woman involved. Two brothers are fighting over this beautiful woman. One brother is killing the other with a knife. That his body might be buried somewhere within the house. All these weird things going on. Frankly, I got to be honest with you, I didn't see anything strange. Of course, being there was strange, but I didn't see any spectral images or anything like that. And Antoinette May, a good friend of mine and a writer for the Chronicle, she wrote The Horoscope, and she's just written Pilot's Wife, a novel. She said she saw some flashes of light, too, during the seance, because I went back and talked to her again recently. The theory was this house, this oldest house in Oakland, California, might have been erected over an old Indian burial ground.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
That was one of the speculations. Another speculation was that a family who had lived there in 1947, woman disappeared, had never been seen. Speculation was that perhaps her body was buried. Now, Michael, do I have time to tell you one last thing?
Sure, we have a few more minutes. Go ahead.
Okay. I had a photographer from the San Francisco Chronicle named Vince Majora. He came over, not during the seance, but a few weeks later. I went back to do an interview with John Slaughter for the Creature Feature Show. And I had a story for the Chronicle plan based on the seance. So he took a lot of photographs. Now, if you go to page 182 of my book, I Was a TV Horror Host, you'll find a reproduction of that photograph. According to Vince, there's all kinds of weird, shadowy, white shadowy substances up near the top roof of the house.
Yeah, I'm looking at it right now.
Yeah.
There's definitely some kind of filmy, foggy,
yeah. And
artificial.
He called me at home that night. My wife and I had gone to film it. We'd come home, and he called me to say that all the pictures turned out normal except this one,
mm-hmm.
and he couldn't explain those strange mists. Now, something else happened, Michael.
Sure.
My wife, Erica, came back from the house, and she went to bed on Friday night, and she didn't get out of bed until Monday morning.
It's a long
and
time
all
to sleep.
Weekend long, I was shaking her. Honey, are you okay? What's wrong? Why are you in bed? She said, all I can do is sleep. Just leave me alone. Let me sleep. And on Monday morning, she finally got up. She has never done that before. It's never happened again. And she claimed that there was a dog that John Slaughter had in the house that looked into her eyes and said, get out of this house. This is a deadly place.
Mm.
And that's all I can tell you. I can't explain. I can't give you any explanation. But
well, I like
she has
way
never
you,
done that before.
You just stick with the facts and tell the truth. I really enjoy that. Let me ask you about a few more celebrities. It seems like when actresses yeah. reach a certain age, they kind of turn to horror films. And a lot of people don't know this, but Joan Collins made some really campy B-horror movies, and then Bette Davis and Joan Crawford kind of winded up their career in these ridiculous films.
Is it because they can't get work anywhere else? I'm really not sure. It's probably because low-budget horror film producers, directors, realize that if I can get an old star that's retired or forgotten to come back, maybe I've got some box office potential.
Really?
Let's talk about Bill Castle, William Castle, can we?
Mm-hmm.
Bill Castle is known, remembered today, for The Tingler and for other films that dealt with gimmicks. In other words, there would be a gimmick, not necessarily up on the screen in the context of the film, but something inside the theater. For The House on Haunted Hill, he had a wire put across the top of the auditorium and a skeleton was pushed across, so at a particular moment in the film, a horrific moment, a skeleton would go sliding across this wire. For the film The Tingler, the seats were electrified so
perfect.
That as you were watching certain sequences, suddenly your seat might tremble a little bit and you might feel a little bit of shock. This was the gimmick. Bill Castle was a brilliant genius at creating the gimmick. And he's the one who provided us with those kinds of things.
Right. Well,
and so getting Joan Crawford to be in one of his films, The Night Walker,
right.
would be just another way of beefing up the box office.
Yeah, she did that Straight Jacket one. But
Straight Jacket. Yeah, I beg your pardon.
Bette
yeah.
Davis.
It's Barbara Stanwyck who is in Night Walker. Yeah.
Well, I'm glad Bette Davis made all those horror movies at the end of her life because it suited her personality, and there was some great stuff in there.
Well, Robert Aldrich, whatever happened to Baby Jane?
Yeah.
Remember Robert Aldrich?
Sure.
He was a great director. Mike, I got to tell you, he was one of my favorite directors. He made a film called Attack. It's a war movie with Jack Palance. Have you ever seen that?
No.
There's a sequence in there where Jack gets run over by a tank, a German tank, and the tank crushes his arm. It's one of those unforgettable, you had to be there back in 1956 in a movie theater to really understand the full impact. Robert Aldrich was a great director of horror sequences, and not necessarily in horror movies, but like in a war movie. He made one of the most shocking war movies of all time in terms of attack. But with Whatever Happened to Baby Jane, that was a masterpiece of its kind, with Olivia de Havilland and Betty Davis actually fighting each other during this film.
There was actually a rivalry. Right? They didn't like each other, so they
Joan Crawford, right?
Must have been very tense. And it kind of came out in the movie, you could tell.
Absolutely. Robert Altridge, to me, was one of the best directors of his time. In fact, because I appreciated his work so much, I would seek him out, and occasionally, one time I went on the set of one of his films. He was shooting up in Sacramento, the Grissom Gang, and his agent took me up there. We arrived there, we walked on the set, he was shooting on location at someone's home there. I walked in, he turned and saw me, and he says, "Oh my God, here comes Stanley. He's going to ask me every question under the sun." Because every time I met Aldridge, I wanted to know about every one of the movies he had ever made. I'd have a list of questions for him. He dreaded the sight of me. He really did.
Well, that's your job as a reporter. Now, tell us quickly, Star Trek, the last person you would think would be involved with the Star Trek would be Lucille Ball. But tell us how she saved the series.
Well, everyone forgets. Everyone thinks that I Love Lucy, the Lucy Show. Lucy was nothing but a comedian and actress. No. From 1961 until 1967, she ran the TV studio Desilu. She and Desi Arnaz had bought it in 1957. Then they divorced in 1960. So shortly after that, Desi got out of the whole business. So Lucy was stuck with running the studio. Now, if you look at the history of Desilu, you realize The Untouchables, Mission Impossible, and Star Trek are three of the greatest series that came out of that studio, and it was during the years that Lucy ran it. Now, in 1966, in February, NBC calls up the studio, Desilu, and says, "We're putting Star Trek into the lineup in September. We need an okay from you that you're going to produce it. We have to have a verification." So all the executives and financial officers of Desilu came to Lucy that week and said, "Lucy, do not greenlight Star Trek. NBC wants to run it this fall. Don't do it. It will destroy you, and it will destroy us and the studio." Why? Because Gene Roddenberry is a madman. He is spending $60,000 and more per episode to make this show. It's going to bankrupt the studio. We're all going to lose our jobs. The studio, Desilu, will be destroyed. And, you know, anyway, Lucy listened to all of this for several days. She listened to all the financial advisors paraded before her. And as Lucy told me, this was in 1975. I was at her home in her backyard with Jackie Gleason and Art Carney. We were listening to her tell a story that all she could remember was that Desilu Studios, that she now ran, was originally RKO Pictures. And RKO Pictures is where she had been a contract player in the late 30s. And one day she came to work to discover she didn't have a job. Her contract had expired. Nobody's going to renew it. Goodbye, Lucy. And she, all she could think about was how horrible she felt the day they had dismissed her. And now here she, ironically, was running the very same studio and faced with the very same problem of dismissing all these wonderful people. Leonard Nimoy, William Shatner, and everybody else associated with the program. And she said, "I didn't have the heart to do it because I didn't want them to feel the way I had felt back in the late 30s when they had dismissed me and told me my contract was up."
And she had some kind of premonition, and thank God she did, huh?
Well, just think about if she had decided yes, that show would have never gone on the air. Now, here's the final irony, Mike. She sold the studio the next year for about $18 million to Paramount, which was right next door to RKO. They tore down a wall. It's all one big studio. And the assets went over to Paramount, Mission Impossible, and Star Trek. And, of course, Star Trek was pretty much at its end then. It just became a property up on the shelf. But in 79, it became a movie series, and that kicked into effect all kinds of movies, television show spinoffs. How many billions of dollars, Mike, has Star Trek earned Paramount and more than paid back the cost of buying Desilu Studios?
Yeah, it was a gold mine, absolutely.
Yep.
Now, we got to go, but before you leave, tell me, are there any underrated horror movies out there that we can watch that have been lost in the shuffle?
I don't know. Is The Thing from Another World, Howard Hawks movie, underrated?
To me, I've never seen it, so that stands out for you.
I'm not sure, but that's the film that inspired me.
Okay.
That's the film that opened up the vista for me.
Well, I'm going to throw out one, Burnt Offerings with Bette Davis. Anyone out there want to see a creepy film? Go see Burnt Offerings with Bette Davis.
Yes, it was made here in the Bay Area, actually. It was made in the Bay Area. I saw it when it came out. But, you know, after you've seen about 10,000 movies, there's only a few of them that really stand out. Is there a reason why that stands out in your mind?
I just remember seeing it as a kid, and there was a creepy person up in the attic, and it just
that wasn't me, was it?
It just scared me. So how can people get your book, real quick, before we have to go?
Well, please go to www.stanleybooks.net. That's the best way to go. We have a PayPal image up there, so you can order it very quickly. It's just $20. For, 559 photographs, 209 pages, stories about the great icons of science fiction and horror of the 20th century, the Star Trek people, the Star Wars people, Vincent Price, Christopher Lee. We've talked about some of the ghost stories tonight.
It's all in there.
Ball. There's so much in there. And Tom Hanks has endorsed this book. So has Ray Bradbury.
All right. Thanks so much for joining me tonight.
Well, thank you.
Take
care,
John.
It's been a great pleasure to relive all this horrible stuff.
It was a lot of fun. Take care. Good night.
Good night.
Okay, we just have a couple more minutes. I just want to remind everybody that, unfortunately, Aaron Russo passed on this month, and he was also a Hollywood producer. He made The Rose with Bette Midler, and he did make one last film before he died, and it was called From Freedom to Fascism. And it's a great, great documentary and story in our banking system. So please watch that for free on the net. It's Aaron Russo, and it's called From Freedom to Fascism. And one more last note. Please, everybody, try to get a hold of Nexus Magazine. It's a really great magazine that covers many of the topics on this story about ancient and modern mysteries. It's spelled N-E-X-U-S, Nexus Magazine. So please check that out as well. And we are flat out of time. Thank you for joining us, and we just wanted to do a fun show. Every once in a while, we do something like that and talk about horror movies and scary movies. Thanks for joining Odyssey. I'll see you next week. Good night.
Hello, Mike. Are you there?
Hold on.
Okay.